You're listening to the Swiss Info Programme. I'm Jo Fay.
I swung the telescope very slowly and carefully up the line of the route, when suddenly, in the frame, there's a figure dressed in red, falling through the frame. He was cartwheeling, I remember that. And he was there, then he was gone.
50 years ago, on March the 22nd, the Eiger Mountains saw an accident that shocked the climbing world. British journalist Peter Gilman watched the tragedy unfold with his own eyes. In this programme, we hear about that moment from Gilman, from a German climber who survived, and from the son who lost his father. At the end of March 2016, these three men were brought together to mark the tragedy and the triumph of 50 years ago. They met at the Grand Hotel Bellevue, perched on a ridge high above the resort of Grindelwald in the Bernese Alps, where two base camps had been set up for the now famous climb of the most direct route of the Eiger Mountain. Two rival teams, one Anglo-American, led by John Harlin, the other a German party and twice the size, were both ready for an assault on the 1,800-metre sheer, icy face. It had been climbed before, but never in a straight line from the bottom to the top.
In the afternoon of March 22nd, around 3 o'clock, I went out onto the terrace, the balcony, where the hotel kept a telescope, which was precisely there for the purpose of looking at what was happening on the face.
Peter Gilman was 24 at the time. He was a reporter for the Daily Telegraph newspaper, which had sponsored the climb, and he'd become the Harlin team's base camp manager.
I'd last spoken to Harlin, John Harlin, about 11:45, and he said they were going for it and they might not be able to keep up radio contact. And that meant the only way we could find out what was going on was to look through the telescopes. And shortly after 3 o'clock, I went to see if I could find out how far Haston and Harlin had reached in their attempts to climb to the spider and catch up with the Germans.
The spider, death bivouac, the fly, these are some of the names given to particular features on this inhospitable alpine wall.
I swung the telescope very slowly and carefully up the line of the route, got to the death bivouac, moved on from there, was going up towards the spider, alongside the central pillar, when suddenly, in the frame, there's a figure dressed in red, falling through the frame. He was cartwheeling, I remember that, and he was there, then he was gone.
Sigi Hupfauer, a member of the German team, was climbing above Harlin when it happened.
Ich hatte bereits die Spinne verlassen und war oben.
I had just left the spider and was above it in the fly. When I got up there, nobody who was already there knew anything, yet it had already happened. It was the second person after me, if I remember correctly, when the rope broke. Put a different way, from where I was, there was a person below me and then Harlin, and then it was over. When you realize that you are on the same line, you understand how lucky you were.
It's quite difficult to work out your feelings then and now, but I was transfixed, appalled by what I'd seen. I couldn't be sure of what I'd seen. I moved the telescope down to see if I could see more. All I saw was some tumbling pieces of snow, and I saw a German climber, apparently who must have seen it, who was looking down in the direction of the fall. I'd cried out, "I've seen someone falling, there's someone falling." There were some other journalists on the terrace. They came forward and looked through the telescope. They couldn't see anything.
Gilman called out to team member and photographer Chris Bonington, who asked him if he was sure about what had happened. Gilman knew what he'd seen, but he didn't want it to be true. Through the telescope, a huddled shape could now just about be made out below the face of the mountain.
Chris Bonington and Leighton Kaur set off on skis to go and see what it was, and I directed them both through the telescope and with the radio. Bonington's carrier radio. And the next moment I remember all too well is Bonington came on the radio and said, "It's John, he's dead."
It was devastating for Gilman. A moment that's never left him. Newspapers were following the climb every step of the way. "Climber killed on Eiger," read the front page headline of Gilman's story in the Daily Telegraph the next day. Gilman's feature story in the April edition of the Telegraph's weekend magazine later took stock of Harlin's achievements, publishing a photo of Harlin on the cover and writing, "He was steadily approaching the most triumphant moment of his life when the rope broke and he fell 4,000 feet to his death."
To be frank, I'd lost a friend, someone I felt close to. I admired him and respected him, enjoyed his company. And there was a professional relationship as well, and that was fine. That's how it is with journalists. You have a professional relationship and you also develop friendships as well. And I had no reservations about him at all, and I was very badly affected by it. I mean, I carried on as one does and did the job that one had to, and after began to reflect on what had happened. But it was, but you can imagine, it was a profoundly shocking moment, and remains so even now as I think about it.
John, Harlan's son, was 9 years old when his father died. He'd last spoken to him a few days earlier.
We drove up to Kleine Scheidegg expecting to see him, that he was going to come down from the wall to visit us. And then when we got here, it was really bad weather. We couldn't see him. We couldn't even see the face. It was just big snowstorm. And we spoke with him by walkie-talkie. So I didn't actually see him then. I spoke by walkie-talkie. Actually, having seen him was probably not since early February, so it was probably almost a month earlier.
He recalls how the news was broken to him.
I was in neighbor's chalet playing with my sister and her and our two friends who are about the same age. So I was 9 years old at the time, and she was eight, and our friends were about the same age. And I just remember we were in his room, Derek's room, and then Mom came in the door crying and saying, "I have some really bad news to tell you." And she told us about Dad having fallen.
John described feeling like his dad was invincible up until that point. He knew that he'd been to other climbers' funerals before, but he never imagined such a loss would happen to his family.
It was, of course, a complete shock, but I remember for myself, I was always really rational, and it just didn't make sense to me that Dad would have fallen, because he just wouldn't make a mistake like that. So why would he have fallen off the mountain? Well, how does that happen? And it didn't fit.
Sigi Hupfauer, a climber in the German team.
Wir haben es ja sehr spät erfahren.
We learnt about it quite late, not at the precise moment, later in the evening. We were afraid because of what happened. Then there was a certain numbness. Even when I think back to that moment today, I shiver. We remained still and didn't know much. My God. And then we had to pull ourselves together to decide how we were going to proceed.
He struggled to find a reason why the accident had happened.
I only wondered afterwards how that could have happened. Why? What was it? We only knew that Harlan wasn't at his full strength on this last day. That's what Dougal Haston said. It could have been a sharp edge of rock that damaged the rope, or the rope could have been struck by a falling rock. There had been a lot of rockfall in the previous few days. It could also have been that ice had formed on his rope clip and slipped, causing Harlan to fall. Due to the extreme pressure, the rope's mantle would have torn and the rest followed.
The attempt was now heavy with the weight of the sadness that came from Harlan's death.
That evening, the evening John died, I took part in the discussion with Dougal Haston on the face as to whether they should carry on. And down at Kleine Scheidegg, I must say that Chris Bonington and I both thought they should give up the climb, but Haston talked us round. He talked to both me and Bonington on the radio and said he wanted to carry on because otherwise John's death would have been in vain. And we wanted the way to give John's death meaning was to carry on and finish the climb, and it would be his memorial climb. Now, climbers are quite good at finding reasons for carrying, but all that seemed to be entirely valid and true.
They carried on. Just five climbers, including Hupfauer, would reach the summit on March the 25th. Injured, half-starving and suffering frostbite, but overall, lucky to be alive. It was more than a month after they'd set off. They'd continued despite Harlan's death only 3 days earlier. Hupfauer relates to what it was like to have lived on the mountain for so many days.
I was in the team that was carrying the supplies up the mountain. I wanted to climb too, but it was clear that we had to provide for the others. We were constantly up and down the wall, all the way to Kleine Scheidegg, and back up again. It wore you down physically. We also were suffering slight frostbite. I trained a lot before the climb, and thanks to that, I didn't freeze to death. At the top, we were very weak. I remember still what it was like in the standing bivouac. During the last few days, we were frozen, starving, weak, but with an incredible will to live and fight on.
They reached the summit on the 25th, and that was an extraordinarily tense day as well, because for a long time we didn't even know if they were still alive, and then I remember we got a glimpse of them, some of the climbers near the top, and we got the radio communication always finished by then. And then we finally heard, I think, from Chris Bonington that he'd made contact with them and they were on the summit. So there's wonderful excitement down there, excitement and relief.
We didn't think about being the first to reach the summit, but just that we had survived. It was a difficult situation, even though there was a fixed rope. But we know now that the piton holding it was only 13 centimeters in the rock, yet the weight of several people were on it. When Dougal Haston reached this rope and had joined with the others, when I arrived at this point, I no longer had an ice axe. We gave our axes to the team above, pushing for the summit. I only had two ice pitons, and we fought our way up with them. My problem was my friend Roland. He was badly injured. He wanted to give up, just to sit there. But I said, "No, we're going together. We'll do it." I spent the whole night helping him, moving his arm so he could go on. Then I was on top, and Roland made it too. And then there was this emptiness, a void. No elation, just we did it. Survived. Maybe just humility that we survived, and that's how I feel about it even today.
Harlan was only 30 years old when he felt his death. As is often the case in extreme sports, the tragedy and not the triumph is what's remembered. And so it is that the name of John Harlan is more closely associated with the Eiger than the five exceptional humans who battled to the top and won, against all odds. Harlan's son John became a climber in his own right, but was often in his father's shadow in the climbing world. It's something that he's come to terms with, though.
Well, I don't think that he's looking down and measuring me in any way, but it's more a matter of itself. Well, it's a combination of self-measurement and also feeling, you know, other people who are seeing and comparing. But I've pretty much gotten beyond that by now. I mean, now I'm twice as old as he was when he died. He was 30, and I'm about to turn 60. And I've done enough things, and I'm climbing hard enough that basically now I take pride in being able to climb as hard as I do, despite my age, whereas before I couldn't use age as a crutch. Now I can use it as my crutch. I'm not bad for an old geezer.
The best-known route, named after Andel Heckmeyer, one of the men who made the first ever ascent of the North Face in 1938, has been climbed countless times since. But the direct route, which was pioneered in 1966, sheer, overhanging, exposed to rock slides and avalanches, has seldom been repeated. Peter Gilman, who spoke to us about these events, published a book in 2015, Extreme Eiger, which tells the story of the climb from the point of view of both teams. The reporting in this programme was by Dale Bechtel. The technician was Daniel Wieler. To read more about the anniversary of the climbing of the Eiger by the direct route, head to our website, swissinfo.ch. You've been listening to the Swiss Info programme, produced by Joe Fay.